Tabitha. She hopes things will get better once they leave the golf club and are on their way home, but instead, things get worse. Once the taxi driver, who doesn't know where he's going and nearly gets into three separate wrecks, delivers them to the ferry, Tabitha and Ainsley go to the office to exchange their tickets so they can take the earlier boat, and Eleanor wanders away like a person with Alzheimer's. They find Eleanor sidled up to the bar at Coupe de Ville, where she has ordered a glass of champagne. Tabitha assumes that at this establishment it's Prosecco, and is telling the buxom young bartender, Carmen, that she is Billy Frost's widow. "I knew Billy well," Carmen says. "He came in here all the time. That was his usual stool over there." She points to an empty stool at the far end of the bar, farthest from the dock and closest to the TV. "Well then," Eleanor says, "that is where I shall sit." Ainsley nudges Tabitha. "Grammy is drunk." Apparently so, Tabitha thinks. Her mother holds her liquor better than anyone Tabitha has ever known, but champagne has always been her Achilles heel. She loves it, but it gets her blotto. Tabitha only saw her drink one glass, maybe two, at the reception, but Eleanor is sneaky and may have consumed as many as four or five glasses, making this her sixth glass. "Mother, we have to go," Tabitha says. "The ferry is leaving." "You have 12 minutes, Carmen says. But even so, she writes out a tab. $5. Cheap Prosecco, Tabitha thinks. Eleanor continues to drink on the boat. The High Line has upped its food and beverage game over the past couple of years. All the soups and sandwiches are made from scratch, and one can even get a decent-looking cheese and fruit platter as well as good wine by the glass or bottle. "They serve Veuve Clicquot," Eleanor announces from her place in line. "Mother, please don't," Tabitha says. She nudges Ainsley. "Can you encourage your grandmother to drink water?" "I'm not doing your dirty work for you, Tabitha," Ainsley says. "I hate you."
"You hate me? Really?
You think because Grammy ruined your life that now it's your job to ruin my life," Ainsley says. "Aunt Harper was smart. She went with Gramps. I'm thinking about going to live with Dad for the summer." Tabitha nearly says he doesn't want you. But that is cruel, primarily because it's true. Wyatt has remarried, sired three sons, ages 10, 7, and 4, and lives with his wife, Becky, in a gracious home overlooking Craigville Beach on the Cape. Becky has a problem with Ainsley. She hates her for no apparent reason other than petty jealousy. She doesn't want Ainsley around the boys, and Wyatt does little in the way of championing his daughter. When he has painting jobs on Nantucket, he will take Ainsley to lunch or dinner. But he never invites Ainsley to the Cape, not even for the weekend. "Okay," Tabitha says neutrally. Eleanor sits down next to Tabitha, sips her champagne, then starts to cry.
"Your father is gone," she says. "He's dead."
Ainsley leans forward.
"Did you love him, Grammy?"
She seems genuinely interested.
"With all my heart," Eleanor says. "I met your grandfather on December 22nd, 1967. He was my cousin Rhonda's date to my parents' annual Christmas party at the country club. Rhonda showed up stoned, and my parents made her leave."
Eleanor closes her eyes, and Ainsley can feel her transporting herself to another time, back when people went to parties in horse-drawn carriages.
"Your grandfather stayed, and we danced all night."
"That sounds romantic," Ainsley says.
"And you know who else I love," Eleanor says. "Your Aunt Harper. I've missed her desperately."
"Really?"
Ainsley says, delighted.
"No," Tabitha says. "That's the champagne talking."
Eleanor reaches across Tabitha to lay a hand on Ainsley's knee.
"Here's the secret to all human relationships," she says. "We humans want what we don't have. Harper went with Billy, and I've longed for her ever since."
"Mother,"
Tabitha says,
"that is simply not true."
"You aren't privy to the secrets of my innermost heart,"
Eleanor says.
Aunt Harper is so cool, Ainsley says. But I'm not talking about how she dresses, obviously.
Eleanor nods.
Her ensemble today was a travesty. I'm going to send her some inventory tomorrow.
She turns to Tabitha.
What size are you, dear?
I'm a size 4, Mother, Tabitha says.
You know I'm a size 4. I'm going to send Harper 2s, Eleanor says. She looked a little thinner than you.
It's just that she acts cool, Ainsley says.
She's chill.
By which I mean the opposite of uptight.
Tabitha can't believe she's hearing this. Eleanor has been pining for Harper ever since Harper left with Billy? That is revisionist history at its most interesting.
Tabitha knows for a fact that Harper used to go visit Eleanor regularly in Boston, although she probably hasn't been since the ghastly drug bust. But still, it's hardly as though they've been kept from each other. The champagne is turning Eleanor into something from Lady Sings the Blues. And Ainsley thinks Harper is chill? Harper is cool? Did Ainsley miss the part of the reception when the wife of Harper's lover, who also happened to be Billy's doctor, slapped Tabitha across the face, mistakenly believing it was Harper? Is it cool to be called a tramp? It's possible that Ainsley doesn't realize the quagmire Harper got herself into 3 years ago, delivering 3 pounds of cocaine to a landscaping client. Harper should rightly have gone to prison. They should be going to visit her at Framingham instead of Martha's Vineyard. Would that be chill? Ainsley may not realize that her aunt now delivers packages for a living. She didn't get hired by UPS or FedEx because she had no decent references, so instead she works for a local operation called Rooster Express. Billy had shown Tabitha a picture of Harper on his phone. Harper was wearing a red collared shirt and a baseball cap emblazoned with an offensively grinning bird. The job is not chill. It is not cool. Harper's life is a shit show. If Tabitha is the only person here who can see that, then fine. Tabitha goes to stand by the window and gaze at the water, which is probably a mistake because the feelings of intense self-reflection return. Billy is dead. Everyone assumes that Harper is the only one who feels this loss, but Tabitha is grieving as well. He was her father, too. She wasn't present for his illness. She wasn't at his bedside the way Harper was, but still Tabitha aches. One more person who was related to Julian is dead. During his annual visits to Nantucket, Billy accompanied Tabitha to the cemetery to place flowers on Julian's grave every August 15, the anniversary of the day Julian died. They would bow their heads, and Billy would say a simple prayer and squeeze Tabitha's hand until she thought it would break.
He's with my mother in heaven, Billy would say. She's taking care of him. You can count on that.
Tabitha had never been particularly religious, but the ritual of going to the cemetery with Billy had comforted her as nothing else had.
Have you ever lost anyone?
Tabitha has now lost her father.
And Harper, Tabitha admits to herself. Seeing her sister today was a trial. Years of anger and hatred had blanketed the truth, which lay underneath like a sediment, nearly disguised but not quite. Tabitha lost her best friend, her sister, her twin. Did Tabitha remember the way Harper used to ride on her back when she was a pony? Of course. Tabitha remembers a lot more than that. She remembers their switching classes at Windsor. Tabitha would double up on art, Harper on English. She remembers them both candy striping at the Brigham, intentionally confusing senile Mrs. Lawson. Tabitha would walk out one door at the same time Harper walked in another, and giving themselves side stitches from laughing so hard. She remembers summer camp at Wyandotte, and how the other girls thought Tabitha and Harper would hate each other, as the twins in The Parent Trap did. But they had been best friends, inseparable. They waded together in their bathing caps at the end of the dock before diving into freezing cold Moose Pond in perfect tandem. They paddled together in the canoe, Tabitha in the stern, Harper in the bow. Tabitha would steer, Harper added power. They lined up side by side in archery, their bows poised exactly the same way. She remembers rock, paper, scissors,
and Harper rolling away with Billy, leaving Tabitha behind to suffer through a future of living up to Eleanor's impossibly high standards. Tabitha had waved goodbye, standing on the brick sidewalk in front of the house on Pinckney Street. But Harper hadn't bothered waving back. She had been too busy fiddling with the radio. Tabitha remembers Harper showing up on Nantucket to help Tabitha take care of Julian. Tabitha stops herself there. When they get home, there's a brown box sitting on the front porch of the carriage house. It's Ainsley's new phone, which cost Tabitha $700, making it more punishing to Tabitha than to Ainsley.
"My phone!"
Ainsley shrieks, and she jumps out of the FJ40, which still smells like cigarettes, while it's moving. Tabitha slams on the brakes. She tries to remind Ainsley that she is grounded from her phone until Friday, but there will be no taking it away from her now. Or rather, Tabitha can take it away, but it will no doubt involve a physical fight in which Tabitha may well get struck for the second time. She isn't up for it.
"You're right, Ramsay," she thinks. "I'm a piss-poor parent. I crumble like a day-old cookie every time."
She watches Ainsley disappear into the carriage house with the box. Tabitha continues down the long white-shell driveway to her mother's house, seamless, a 4,500-square-foot edifice with 3 floors, 6 bedrooms, 6.5 baths, and a glassed-in porch that perches on the edge of a cliff, offering uninterrupted views of Nantucket Sound. Tabitha has always assumed that someday this house will be hers, as well as the townhouse on Pinckney Street, although lately Eleanor has been dodgy about money. The ERF boutique on Newbury Street folded the year before, and Eleanor must have sustained a hit to her finances and her ego, although she was predictably stoic about both. Tabitha has always assumed that Eleanor is sitting on a comfortable cushion of cash, but obviously it wasn't enough to save the flagship store. The Nantucket store will be the next to sink, short of a miracle, despite Tabitha's efforts to diversify the inventory. The Palm Beach store is just fine because, well, because the clientele in Palm Beach is old. Older. "Do you need help getting inside, Mother?" Tabitha asks. Eleanor inhales dramatically. "You have no idea how today taxed me."
"It taxed all of us," Tabitha says.
"I got slapped," she thinks, "and doused." Her dress looks pretty good, considering. Another selling point for the Roxy. It can absorb a full glass of champagne without showing a stain or a wrinkle.
"He was my father."
"He was my husband," Eleanor says.
"Ex-husband," Tabitha says. "You were divorced from Billy longer than you were ever married to him."
"I don't expect you to understand," Eleanor says.
"I don't understand," Tabitha says. "I find this sudden mourning and this heartbreak a little manufactured and more than a little self-serving. Billy lived 11 miles away. Did you ever go to see him? When he was here on Nantucket, did you ever offer to take him to lunch? Or to invite him inside this house?"
"No."
"When his name came up, you insulted him. You outgrew Billy long ago. You divorced him, then you forgot about him, Mother. I can't believe you're now telling my daughter that you loved him with all your heart."
"You've never been married, Pony," Eleanor says. She reaches into her purse and pulls out a newspaper clipping. She hands it to Tabitha.
"What's this?" Tabitha says.
She unfolds the clipping. It's well-worn, softened, and smudged. It's a photograph of Billy and Eleanor. Eleanor smiling as though she's won $50 million in the lottery. Billy kissing her cheek. The caption reads, "Boston Royalty. Fashion designer Eleanor Roxy Frost and husband Billy Frost enjoy an evening out at Loch Ober to raise funds for the Boston Public Library. Ms. Roxy Frost wears a gown of her own design." Tabitha has seen dozens of such photographs of Billy and Eleanor together, and she always thinks the same thing. "Those were the days, my friend. We thought they'd never end." But end they did. Still, This photograph prompts Tabitha to acknowledge her mother's sorrow. Eleanor thought to bring this clipping to Billy's memorial reception. It means something to her. Even after all the years of contempt and disregard, she might still have loved him. Tabitha can't deal with the emotion right now. She's too exhausted. So instead, she says, "I don't think I've ever seen that dress." It's a long, strapless column of dark silk with a pleated top reminiscent of a Japanese fan. "I still have it," Eleanor says. "Someday it will go to the Smithsonian." "I'm sure it will," Tabitha says. "It's very..." She nearly says pretty, but pretty has never meant anything to Eleanor. "Strong. Makes a statement. Perhaps you should bring it back." She returns the clipping to Eleanor. "Perhaps I should," Eleanor says. She tucks the clipping into her purse before laboriously getting out of the car. She's less steady on her feet these days, especially when she's wearing heels, slingbacks at that, and she's had at least half a dozen glasses of champagne. Tabitha should walk her to the door, help her get situated inside, make her a cup of tea, fix her a snack, fetch her a robe. But no, Tabitha won't do it. Not tonight. She's too angry, and the things Eleanor has said today are too hurtful. Eleanor longs for Harper. Fine. From now on, when Eleanor wants something, she can ask Harper for it. Harper can manage the Nantucket store, maybe sell meth or heroin in addition to the Eleanor Roxy Frost label. That, at least, would put an end to their cash flow problems. "Have a good night, Mother," Tabitha says. Eleanor makes her wobbly way up the flagstone path toward the steps of the front porch. Tabitha studies the grandness of the house and decides that she will throw a party there in a few weeks when Eleanor goes to New York to meet with the Taylors and ERF manufacturing people. Ha! Tabitha is no better than Ainsley. But really, Eleanor's house is ideal for entertaining. Cocktails on the porch, buffet dinner in the dining room, dancing in the living room. Maybe Tabitha will invite Captain Peter. Maybe she'll invite young Zach, the bartender from Nautilus. She will definitely invite Stephanie Beasley now that Ainsley and Candace are friends again. And maybe Teddy's Uncle Graham while she's at it. She needs more friends, she thinks. Ainsley is right. Eleanor has ruined her life. Eleanor climbs the stairs holding on to the rail. It's like watching paint dry, Tabitha thinks. She'll invite the Tallahasseans. Harper has been conducting an affair with Billy's married doctor. Does no one but Tabitha find this disgusting? Eleanor reaches the porch and turns around to wave, or maybe not wave, maybe signal, because she is now crying. She steps forward. Possibly she wants to apologize to Tabitha, or maybe she's left her reading glasses in Tabitha's car. But she misjudges her footing and falls down the porch stairs, landing in a heap at the bottom. Ainsley. She is so busy getting her phone up and running that she doesn't know anything is wrong until she hears the ambulance sirens. At first they're distant, and she barely registers them. But then they get closer. And then they're basically on top of her, and she looks out the window and sees the flashing blue and red lights pull into their driveway. She spies the distant figure of her mother waving the ambulance over in the direction of Grammy's house. Ainsley dashes out the front door in time to see the paramedics sliding Grammy onto a stretcher and into the back of the ambulance. Tabitha gets in her car, does a donut in the driveway, and follows the ambulance out. When she sees Ainsley, she puts down her window. "Grammy fell. I'm going with her to the hospital. Do you want to come with me or stay here?" "Stay here," Ainsley says. She feels bad for that choice, but her mother actually looks relieved. "Does your phone work?" "Yes." "I'll call you," Tabitha says. And off she goes. Ainsley goes back into the house alone. This is what she's been waiting for since Friday night, to be left alone with a mode of communication, yet she regrets the answer she gave her mother. She should have gone to the hospital. What if her grandmother dies? What if she loses both of her grandparents in the same week? She waits for her phone to boot up. She's expecting a host of texts and missed calls, but only one text comes in from Emma, dated Sunday at noon. It says, "Head hurts. Call me." That's it? Ainsley thinks. Nothing from Teddy? He doesn't know her phone was drowned, although maybe he guessed. He doesn't know her grandfather died and that she went to the memorial on the vineyard. She has been completely out of touch. She assumed he would try to contact her, yet her phone shows nothing. Did he go to the jetties to see G-Love with Emma? Emma complained of a headache at noon on Sunday, but that doesn't mean she didn't rally for a big rager on Sunday night. Maybe Teddy lost his phone privileges as well. Maybe Uncle Graham finally went to the library and checked out a parenting manual. But somehow Ainsley doesn't think so. Teddy didn't do anything wrong except spend his date money on vodka. Maybe Teddy's mother showed up, fresh out of Brookhaven Hospital in Tulsa, and took Teddy back to Oklahoma with her. This is what would happen in a Charles Dickens novel. Ainsley has been paying enough attention in English class to know this much. Ainsley calls Teddy. When he answers, he sounds weary. "Hey, Ainsley."
"Teddy?" she says. "My mom sunk my phone on Saturday night, which is why I haven't called. And then we found out on Sunday morning that my grandfather died, but I still had no way to reach you. I missed school today because we went to the memorial reception on the vineyard. I just got back, and my new phone was here, so that's good news. But the bad news is that my grandmother got drunk at the reception and fell down. An ambulance came, and now she and my mother are at the hospital. I'm here alone." She swallows. "Can you come over?" She's asking not because she wants to have sex, but rather because she could really use some companionship, a friend. Her mother doesn't want her at the hospital, and can Ainsley blame her? On the ferry, Ainsley told Tabitha she hated her.
"Please, Teddy?"
"Ainsley," Teddy says, "I've got something to tell you." Ainsley understands how her mother must have felt earlier that afternoon, struck out of the blue for no discernible reason. "I want to break up," Teddy says.
"What?" Ainsley says. "Why?"
"Why?" Teddy says.
"Why?" Ainsley says. "Is it Emma? Did you take Emma with you to see G-Love at the jetties?"
"I didn't go to the jetties, and G-Love never showed anyway," Teddy says. "And this has nothing to do with Emma. I like someone else."
Ainsley sucks in her breath. "Someone else?" she says. "Who?"
"Candace," Teddy says. "I like Candace."
"Candace," Ainsley thinks. "Candace Beasley? Measly Beasley?"
Ainsley thinks Teddy must be kidding, but then he launches into a monologue about how he needs positive influences in his life. He can't get caught up with the drinking and the smoking. If he gets in trouble and Graham kicks him out, he's looking at foster care or a group home. Candace is an A student and an altar girl at St. Mary's. She and Teddy were the only ones at Ainsley's party who stayed sober. Teddy called her on Sunday, and they met for a walk on the beach. They talked. He tried to kiss her, but she wouldn't let him until he'd properly broken up with Ainsley.
"She doesn't want to hurt you," Teddy says. "She doesn't want you to be able to say she stole me from you, because it isn't like that."
Ainsley is speechless. She is stuck back on the phrase positive influences. Isn't Ainsley a positive influence? Was she not the one who befriended Teddy when he first arrived on Nantucket? He could have been an outcast, a weird loner from Oklahoma, but Ainsley had introduced him to all her friends. She had included him. And then soon afterward, once they started dating, she had given him her virginity. She understands that he doesn't want to mess up and get in trouble. He doesn't have to drink or smoke. She has never pressured him to do so. Maybe Ainsley isn't on the honor roll. Maybe Ainsley isn't an altar girl at St. Mary's. Her mother never had her baptized, much less confirmed, but she has a heart, and her heart loves Teddy. Candace Beasley. Backstabber, Ainsley thinks. She will destroy Candace Beasley. She will destroy Candace and Teddy together. They can be good people, but they will be alone. Ainsley recognizes those last few thoughts as those of an evil, vengeful person, which is exactly what pushed Teddy away. Ainsley takes a deep breath.
I'm sure she doesn't want to hurt me. Candace and I used to be best friends. Then we drifted apart. When I invited her over on Saturday, it was because I wanted to try to get close to her again.
That's what she told me, Teddy says. She also told me that you and Emma have been pretty mean to her.
We have been, Ainsley admits. And now she's exacting her revenge. I'm sure you guys will be happy together. Happier than you and I were. I wish you the best.
Ainsley, Teddy says.
Goodbye, Ted,
Ainsley says, and she hangs up. Ainsley stares at her phone for a few seconds. She's proud of herself for not kirking out. She handled herself exactly as her grandmother might have. But wow, she hurts. Tears sting her eyes. She's upset about Teddy and Candace. She's worried about her grandmother, and she is so, so sad about Billy. The only good thing that has happened is that she got to see Aunt Harper, but even that visit was cut short. Ainsley picks up her phone to call Emma. But Emma isn't good at commiseration. She doesn't know how to be comforting or supportive. Neither do BC and Maggie and Anna. Ainsley has chosen friends who are too cool for any kind of genuine human emotion. Should she call her father? Ask him if maybe she can spend the summer on the Cape? She could work as a nanny for her half-brothers. Right now, she's supposed to put in 40 hours a week at the ERF boutique, but Ainsley would love to tell her mother she's found a better job. Tabitha probably doesn't want Ainsley to work at the boutique anyway. If Ainsley goes to the Cape, Tabitha will be able to hire someone reliable and competent, someone she will be able to trust rather than doubt. What does it say when your own mother doesn't believe in you? Ainsley dials her father's number, but after 6 rings, it goes to his voicemail. Ainsley hangs up. She's not sure whether Tabitha has told Wyatt about Ainsley stealing the car and throwing the party, but if she has, then it's safe to say a summer on the Cape is out of the question. Becky, Ainsley's stepmother, or more accurately, Wyatt's wife, hates Ainsley. She doesn't allow Ainsley within 5 feet of the boys. Ainsley's phone rings. It's her mother.
Grammy broke her hip, Tabitha says.
Ainsley exhales.
But she's okay otherwise? She's alive?
She's alive, but the break is bad, and they're flying her to Boston on the MedFlight helicopter. I have to fly to Boston, too. I would have you come with me, but I don't want you to miss any more school. So, what do you think? Can you stay home by yourself tonight? There's cash in the tea tin if you want to order a pizza for dinner, or there's a hunk of low-fat Gouda in the deli drawer. No rice crackers, though. We finished those up last night.
Will you be home tomorrow? Ainsley asks.
I'm not sure, sweetheart, but I have to go with your grandmother. She doesn't have anyone else. Please, please just be good until I get back. Do your homework, take the bus to school. No smoking, no drinking, no parties. Okay?
Okay, Ainsley says. I promise.
She hangs up. Broken hip. Not the worst news, but still serious. Ainsley gets that. Why do old people always break their hips? It's like a thing. So now Ainsley has the house to herself, overnight and maybe longer. 3 hours ago, this was exactly what Ainsley dreamed of, but right now, well, she feels more miserable than she has in all her life. Harper. When she wakes up the morning after Billy's memorial reception, the answer is clear. she has to leave the vineyard. Harper's phone continued to blow up the night before, to the point where she wished her phone would physically blow up. There were texts from Drew and from an unfamiliar number, which turned out to be Drew's cousin Jethro, the son of Wanda, the aunt who made the stew. Harper deletes these texts without reading them. She feels anew the shame of 3 years earlier. What had she learned then? The vineyard is a great place to live until you screw up. Being part of a community means you have a responsibility to behave, to obey the laws, to act like a decent human being. And when you don't, you let everyone else in the community down. There was a text from the other Rooster Express driver, a former addict named Adele, that said, "Is it true?" There was, most frighteningly, a text from Jude, Harper's former employer. Harper wasn't sure why she even kept Jude's contact information in her phone. They had agreed never to communicate again. Harper stupidly thought that maybe Jude had heard about Billy's death and decided to reach out, but the text said, "Scum." After that, Harper was determined to flush her phone down the toilet. But then a text came in from Rooster, her boss, and Harper thought it might have been a change to her work schedule. The text said, "Listen to your voicemail, please, Harper. Or just call me back." Harper sighed, then played her voicemail. "Hi, Harper. It's Rooster. Sorry I missed Billy's reception. I was in the weeds with you taking the day off. I heard some pretty weird shit went down at the golf club, and it sounds like maybe you have some personal issues you need to work out. So anyway, I'm relieving you of your delivery duties for the foreseeable future. Sorry about that, Harper." Harper replayed the message because she couldn't understand what he was trying to tell her. Relieving her of her delivery duties for the foreseeable future? Was he firing her? Yes, it seemed he was. There was also a voicemail from Tabitha. It had come in at 2:30 in the morning. Harper hadn't listened to it, because how much abuse, really, was she expected to take? Reed gone. Drew gone. Her job gone. She has to leave. Where she'll go is less of a concern than the steps she needs to take to wrap up her life here. She has to go over to Chappie to see Brendan, but that will need to wait. She has to pay Kendall at the golf club, as the reception was far from free, but she'll deal with Kendall by email because by now he's probably heard the reason for Sadie Zimmer's outrageous behavior. It was justified. Harper had been sleeping with her husband, the wonderful member in good standing, the island's favorite doctor, a man as squeaky clean as Marcus Welby, M.D., Dr. Reed Zimmer. No, Harper thinks. Sadie's behavior was not justified. Showing up at Billy's memorial to slap Harper in front of the assembled guests? Unacceptable. And why is Harper the only one being held accountable for the infidelity? She isn't married. She isn't betraying anyone at home. Well, okay, she was betraying Drew. He thinks they agreed to be exclusive, but they've only been dating for 3 weeks. They haven't even slept together, and Harper knows the word exclusive never crossed her lips. But why isn't anyone vilifying Reed? Why is it Harper who is cast as the evil seductress? Does it go all the way back to Nathaniel Hawthorne? Yes, she supposes it does. The house. She has to sell Billy's house, and fast. She needs a real estate agent. Is there anyone left on the vineyard who might still speak to her? She snaps her fingers. Polly. Polly Childs has been through this. Back when she was a sales associate at Shipshape Real Estate, she slept with her boss, Brock, while Brock and Polly were married to other people. Both marriages broke up, and Polly took a trip to Ethiopia, where she traced her ancestry back to the royal family. At least, that was the rumor, and did some humanitarian work. When she returned to the vineyard, she had reinvented herself enough to get a job at Up Island Real Estate, where her African princess self proceeded to make a killing. She immediately sold a harborfront home in Edgartown to the famous talk show host Sunday Stewart. This had been major vineyard news. It was made even bigger when Polly and Sunday were caught fooling around in the master bedroom suite by Sunday's actress lover, Cassandra Kay. The public relations frenzy had been insane on a national level. The supermarket tabloids, TMZ. For a full celebrity gossip news cycle, 9 days, Polly Child's name was mentioned everywhere you looked. Harper would have locked herself in a car and driven off Dyke Bridge, but Polly had held her head high. Harper had seen her in the produce section of Kronig's that week, and in an attempt at normalcy, Harper had asked Polly the best way to tell if a pineapple is ripe. Polly had informed Harper in a normal, cheerful voice that if a whole pineapple gives off a sweet fragrance, it's ready to eat. Harper calls Polly and says, "Polly, it's Harper Frost. I'm looking to sell my father's house. I need to get off this island." There is silence from Polly, and Harper thinks that maybe even Polly Childs is unwilling to do business with her, for she's certain that Polly has already heard the rumors. The real estate offices are hotbeds of gossip. If Polly can't help, then Harper has truly sifted down to join the cast of Untouchables. Finally, Polly says, "I know the house. Daggett Avenue? I'll meet you there in 15 minutes. Polly arrives first, as Harper had to feed fish and let him out, then change her clothes. She had fallen asleep in the black outfit she wore to the reception, and brush her teeth and wash her face in an attempt to make herself look respectable. Harper is wearing white denim shorts, a pale blue golf shirt that used to belong to Billy before Harper requisitioned it for gardening purposes, a Red Sox hat, and her father's watch. She is the world's most underwhelming mistress. Polly, by comparison, is wearing, well, here Harper blinks. She's wearing one of Harper's mother's designs, the Roxy, in amethyst purple, a color that makes her skin look like polished bronze. Harper knows nothing about fashion, but she would know her mother's dress, that dress, anywhere. It's a linen shift with an obi. Obis were a fashion statement made popular by geisha girls in Japan. Eleanor's entire empire is based on reworking a symbol of female subservience and turning it into something empowering. "I like your dress," Harper says. "I like your watch," Polly says. "Stylish. Makes a statement. I should get a man's watch." "It was my father's," Harper says. "You have my condolences," Polly says. "I heard I missed meeting your mother yesterday by a minute or two. I went to Farm Neck for a late lunch." "That's not all you missed," Harper says. Polly smiles in an inscrutable way. Now would be the time for Polly to say something encouraging, maybe dust off the old chestnut about the man who sees his friend down in a hole and jumps into the hole with him because he's been there before and knows the way out. Polly clearly found her way out. She looks fantastic. Harper wonders if she's still seeing Sunday Stewart. Sunday and Cassandra Kay have split. That much has been well documented, at which point Polly vaporized from the story. Maybe Harper doesn't have to leave. Maybe she can ride this out. But then she thinks of Jude's text, "Scum." Scum, like you find in a ring around the bathroom sink, or like peanut butter that has collected inside the lid of the jar. Harper has to go. "Anyway, here it is," Harper says, pointing to the house. It's only now that she thinks to worry about the state of things inside. Harper has been here periodically to grab things for Billy, but no one has been in to clean, and the weather has warmed up considerably. But Harper hadn't thought to open any windows. So when she unlocks the door and she and Polly step inside, they are both assaulted by a wave of stale, hot, foul-smelling air. Polly keeps her game face on. Surely this isn't the worst house she's seen on the island, right?
"Your father was a smoker?" Polly asks.
"Pack a day," she says, hence the congestive heart failure at age 73.
"Did he have a dog?"
Polly asks.
"No," Harper says, "no dog."
Technically, this is true, but Fish was over here all the time, and Billy had no rules,
so Fish used to lie across the sofa like a fat pasha. Polly can probably smell him, and although huskies aren't known as shedders, Fish still leaves hair wherever he goes. Harper knows that Polly will not approve of the wall-to-wall carpeting, but Billy was adamant that he liked the feel of it under his feet.
Much friendlier than wood floors, he said.
Harper is sure Polly will also not approve of the recliner or the clunky old coffee table reclaimed from the dump or the Jaws poster hanging on the wall in the powder room. Billy had been inordinately proud that the movie was filmed on the vineyard. If Harper closes her eyes, she can hear Billy's voice clear as day.
You're gonna need a bigger boat.
Harper says, I'll give you the grand tour. She leads Polly through the living room into the dining room, where the table is covered with old onion lamps, broken fixtures, wires, cords, outlet covers, bulbs of various shapes and sizes, and a pile of unpaid invoices. Harper will have to deal with what's owed, referring Billy's current customers elsewhere and dismantling the business. It might be a good thing she got fired. The dining room has four tall, skinny windows that look out onto the backyard, which is a nice size but completely unkempt. Woods and unmowed grass, in the midst of which is a patch of overgrown vegetable garden. Billy had allowed Harper to put it in back when she was still working for Jude, and in the first season they harvested zucchini, cucumbers, cherry tomatoes, and one enormous misshapen pumpkin that won honorable mention at the Ag Fair. Windows, Polly says, like a toddler learning new words. Yard. They head into the kitchen, which Harper knows is the weak link. It features peeling linoleum floors, stained formica countertops, and particle board cabinets, several of which are loose on their hinges. With a stranger standing next to her, Harper can see how terribly the house presents, but she never gave it any thought because it was what it was. Billy's house. The fridge is 100 years old, but it kept Billy's beer cold. Billy would rather have eaten takeout from the home port every night than spend money on renovating the kitchen. But the kitchen looks so bad that Harper feels she should apologize. Needs work, Polly says with a rise of her perfectly plucked eyebrows. Rest of the house? They wander through the 3 bedrooms upstairs, including the lavender bedroom that belonged to Harper before she finally moved out a week after her 37th birthday. They peek in the 2 underwhelming bathrooms. The tile floors are fine, but the sinks and tubs and toilets are outdated. And one of the bathrooms is Billy's and still has a can of shaving cream on the sink, along with his green comb. The green comb had been Billy's since the beginning of time. It probably cost him 5 cents at a drugstore on Charles Street in Boston in 1978, but it's so deeply ingrained in Harper's mind as Billy's comb that it's as if his beating heart is there on the bathroom counter. Harper struggles not to lose her composure in front of Polly Childs. They peer into the shallow linen closet, then into the deeper closet that holds the washer and dryer. Laundry, Polly says. Good. Well, yeah, Harper says. The house is an eyesore. She understands this anew, but at least they aren't hanging out at the laundromat every Saturday. Polly turns to Harper and says, Listen, I'm not going to bullshit you. Harper nods. Good. Although really, she could use a little candy coating, a little pie in the sky. You have 2 options, Polly says. We sell this as a tear-down, lot only. Listings in Vineyard Haven have taken a nosedive lately. This town can't decide what it wants to be. And Daggett Avenue is... meh. So it would be listing at 6, closing at 500,000. Oh, Harper says. This is far less than she anticipated. The other option? You got it. New kitchen, obviously, new bathrooms. The whole house needs a new coat of paint. You pull up the carpet, restore those wood floors, buy new furniture, every stick, and hire a landscaper. If you pour $125,000-$150,000 into this place, I would list it as 1.1, and you walk with $1,000,000, guaranteed. Harper stares at Polly's feet.
She's wearing Jack Rogers sandals, the same color purple as her Roxy, and her toenails match as well. How does she do it? Harper wonders. How, with all she's been through, does she keep on keeping on?
Can I sleep on it? She asks.
Absolutely, Polly says. Call me tomorrow. Harper drives home slowly, and all the while, her phone buzzes. It's Drew calling. What did he not understand about their last conversation? They went on 6 dates, and now the relationship is over. The phone rings again, and Harper thinks, that's it. She's going to throw the phone out the window, then back up over it. She checks the display. Nantucket, MA. It's not Tabitha's phone, but maybe it's the landline. Maybe her mother's landline. Despite Harper's conflicting emotions, she needs to talk to someone with taste and good business sense about Billy's house. She answers. Hello?
Aunt Harper?
It's Ainsley.
Grammy fell and broke her hip. Mom's with her in Boston at the hospital, and I'm here on Nantucket by myself. I was wondering, well, is there any way you can come over?
Come over? Harper says. She's not sure what Ainsley means. To Nantucket, you mean?
Yes, Ainsley says. Can you please?
Harper is taken hostage by the novelty of the situation. Someone is seeking out her company. But then reality intercedes. What does your mother think about this? She asks.
She says it's totally fine, Ainsley says. She would appreciate your help.
There is no way this is true. Tabitha could be bleeding out in a school of great white sharks and she wouldn't appreciate Harper's help. But then Harper remembers the voicemail that came in at 2:30 in the morning. She hasn't bothered listening to it, but maybe it is indeed Tabitha asking for help. Really? Harper says.
Really?
Ainsley says. Tabitha. The break is bad. And after Eleanor is seen by Dr. Karabinis, the orthopedist at Mass General who specializes in geriatric hip breaks, it is determined that Eleanor will need surgery. There is no one to operate tonight, so they've stabilized the leg, managed Eleanor's pain, and they will operate in the morning. Recovery takes 6 to 8 weeks and involves bed rest and physical therapy. Thankfully, Eleanor is knocked out and can't argue with her treatment plan, though argue she will, eventually. Tabitha accepts this news stoically, although inside her is a 3-ring circus of despair, angst, and resentment. Eleanor is, essentially, out of commission. And not only that, she's going to need help. Hiring a live-in nurse comes to mind, although Eleanor is finicky about strangers and will, no doubt, want Tabitha to serve as the nurse. A live-in nurse is also expensive, probably more than $1,000 a day, $7,000 a week, $30,000 a month, adding up to a grand total of $45,000 to $60,000, depending on how quickly Eleanor heals. Eleanor may have that kind of cash lying around, but if she does have it, she won't want to spend it. At the end of the day, there's no one more frugal than a Yankee wasp. And if she doesn't have it, that's even worse news. Tabitha will have to live in Boston this summer with her mother. But if Tabitha does that, who will run the Nantucket store during its peak season? They can't close the store. They owe $80,000 in rent. There's the manager, Megan, who is perfectly capable, but she's 8 months pregnant. First babies are often late, so Tabitha had hoped to make it through the 4th of July weekend, during which time Megan would teach Ainsley everything she knows, and Ainsley would take Megan's place with Tabitha right there overseeing. Ainsley, if Tabitha moves to Boston for 6 or 8 weeks, what will happen to Ainsley? She's too young to stay by herself. She would burn the carriage house down and turn Eleanor's house into an opium den. Tabitha shudders as she imagines the Snapchat photos. Ainsley and Emma in string bikinis, pounding cans of Coors Light, doing bong hits, modeling Tabitha's entire wardrobe. It might even get worse. Nude photos,
cocaine, older men. No, Ainsley can't stay alone. But Ainsley will refuse to come to Boston. Of this, Tabitha is certain. Would Wyatt agree to have her live with him on the Cape? That might work, except Tabitha really needs Ainsley to work at the store. If Tabitha were still with Ramsay, there would be no problem. Ramsay would have stayed with Ainsley and kept her in line. He would have had her reading Ayn Rand. He would have taught her to make her bed with hospital corners. He would have delivered her to and from work, and then, once the weather grew consistently clement, he would have made her ride her bike. He would have taken her to dinner at the yacht club on Friday nights and made certain she ordered Shirley Temple's. But Ramsay is gone. Ramsay is with Kaylee, and even someone as young and freewheeling as Kaylee would probably not be okay with her new boyfriend caring for his ex-girlfriend's teenage daughter. Tabitha can't worry about the summer right now. Right now, she has to see Eleanor safely through her surgery. Tabitha will stay in Boston tonight, tomorrow night, and maybe Wednesday night as well. She needs someone to go stay with Ainsley. Whom can she ask? Ramsay is out, which leaves. Well, the girl has a father. Tabitha calls Wyatt. Tabitha? He says. He sounds surprised, wary. She rarely phones him. Most of their communication about Ainsley is done via email. Everything okay? Not really, Tabitha says, and she bites her bottom lip. Like her mother, Tabitha sees no point in dwelling on the past or reflecting on what might have been, but for some reason, hearing Wyatt's voice takes her back. She's 22 years old, and he's a year older, standing on a ladder painting the trim on the next-door neighbor's house. Tabitha has wandered over to the Coleman's yard to gather up Blaise Pascal, Eleanor's dachshund, who has run off. Wyatt is wearing wraparound Oakleys and a Cornell University visor. His brown hair has flecks of white paint in it.
Do you go to Cornell? Tabitha asks.
Nah, he says. This is my roommate's. Tabitha knew right then what she should do. Ask this guy to give his roommate Tabitha's number. But Wyatt is cute, and Tabitha doesn't want to offend him. Wyatt smiles. You live next door, right? I've noticed you walking your dog. If you're not busy later, the Radiators are playing at the Muse. I have an extra ticket.
I'd love to go, Tabitha says. That's the thing about relationships, Tabitha thinks. They start innocently, based on shared interests, hormones, and the prospect of fun.
She and Wyatt go to see the Radiators at the Muse. They dance and drink cheap draft beer. They kiss in the front seat of Wyatt's Jeep, in front of Steamboat Pizza. They have sex for the first time 3 days later on the tiny harborfront beach in front of Sales Seafood, on top of an overturned kayak. Wyatt doesn't have an Ivy League education or a college education of any kind. Painting houses, smoking weed, and seeing bands are the way he spends his time. He has no ambitions, but Tabitha convinces herself it doesn't matter. No matter where this relationship goes, it will end on Labor Day. They become boyfriend and girlfriend and drive out to see the sunset in Matticat and go to bonfires with the guys Wyatt paints with and go to the Dreamland Theater to see Armageddon on the one day that it rains. When Tabitha leaves for Boston to start working for her mother, she stands at the railing of the ferry waving a fond adieu to Wyatt, and she marvels at what a storybook summer romance she has just enjoyed. A week later, she will discover that she is pregnant. When Tabitha tells Eleanor, she expects her mother will insist she and Wyatt get married. But Eleanor does just the opposite. She doesn't think Wyatt is good enough for Tabitha to marry. She says, "Don't make," but then she trails off, leaving Tabitha to finish the thought. "Don't make the same mistake I did." Tabitha is incensed by this. She is sick of Eleanor's innate sense of superiority, just because Eleanor's father was a bank president and her mother a miserable matron of Beacon Hill. Tabitha nearly marries Wyatt out of spite, but in her heart, Tabitha knows she doesn't love him enough to stay married forever, and she will not get divorced.
as Eleanor and Billy did. Not ever.
Is it Ainsley? Wyatt asks. Is she in jail?
Did she run off and elope? Did she OD?
Tabitha laughs, though, sadly. None of those guesses is out of the question.
Ainsley is fine. Or sort of. So, I should have told you this earlier. My father died.
And I should have called you earlier, Wyatt says, because I saw your sister's post on Facebook.
You're friends with my sister on Facebook?
Tabitha says.
Tell me you're kidding.
Tabitha, stop. Tabitha has a lot of old hurt inside her, and this man knows how to tap into it.
You're right, she says. You should have called. He's your daughter's grandfather.
You should have told me, Wyatt says. I shouldn't have had to find out on social media. He huffs. Listen, I'm sorry about Billy. He was a great guy. Whenever I had jobs on the vineyard, I met him for lunch.
You met my father for lunch? She says. I'm sure you saw Harper while you were at it.
Tabitha, stop.
Stop, she thinks.
Pursuing this particular strain of conversation will lead to no good. Tabitha takes a sustaining breath.
I can't begin to explain what happened at the memorial reception, so all I'll say is that my mother drank too much, and when we got home to Nantucket, she fell down the front steps of her house and broke her hip.
Oh, geez, Wyatt says.
And so now I'm in Boston, and she's having surgery tomorrow, and I won't be able to get home until Wednesday night at the earliest, and I'm wondering if you might be able to go over to the island and keep an eye on Ainsley.
Wow, Wyatt says, and Tabitha immediately knows what's coming.
I wish I could, she mouths.
I wish I could, he says, but I have a project in Orleans that's on deadline. Then Carpenter has pink eye, so our house is kind of on lockdown.
I wasn't suggesting Ainsley go there, Tabitha says. I know Becky doesn't like her.
Becky likes her just fine, Wyatt says in a combative tone. But I have 3 kids, Tabitha.
You have 4 kids, Tabitha says.
You had 5 kids, she thinks. She wonders how often Wyatt thinks about Julian.
And one of them needs you.
Don't be this way, Tabitha, please.
You're her father, Tabitha says. Act like it for once.
Goodbye, Tabitha, Wyatt says, and he hangs up, leaving Tabitha to watch his name vanish from her cell phone screen. She supposes that asking Wyatt to take Ainsley for the summer is out of the question.
Whom else can Tabitha call? The next person who comes to mind is Stephanie Beasley. Candace had been at that party, which is both good news and bad news. It's good news because apparently Ainsley and Candace are friends again, and it's bad news because if Stephanie has found out about the details of the party, she will never let Ainsley stay there. Tabitha has to ask. She will not have Ainsley staying with Emma Marlowe and her father. Tabitha imagines more Snapchat photos. Ainsley and Emma and Dutch all doing shots of Jack Daniels and snorting lines of cocaine off the granite countertops in the kitchen. Ainsley in lingerie, sitting on Dutch's lap. No. Tabitha is too emotionally spent to have a reunion phone call with Stephanie, so she sends a text.
Hey, stranger. My mother broke her hip. I'm in Boston at MGH, and Ainsley is at home on Nantucket. Is there any way I could impose on you and Stu and ask you to take Ainsley in for 2 to 3 nights? I know it's an enormous favor out of the blue, but I'm desperate. I'll make it up to you. Thanks, XO.
She's a coward, sending a text. They're talking about the well-being of Tabitha's only child. Tabitha hates herself. She should have called. Yes, it would have been awkward. It's easily been 4 years since Tabitha and Steph have had any kind of meaningful conversation, but sending a text was too casual. As if to punish Tabitha for her cavalier handling of the situation, her phone pings with a response.
I checked with Candace. She doesn't think having Ainsley here is a good idea. Sorry I couldn't be of more help. XO.
Oh, sure, Tabitha thinks,
Blame it on the 16-year-old.
In her heart, she knows this is the answer she deserves. Tabitha will have to call Megan and ask her to stay at the carriage house. There is simply no one else. Megan is as big as a house, and her pregnancy has been a trial. She has developed carpal tunnel syndrome and gestational diabetes. Her ankles are so swollen that she can't wear shoes, only flip-flops. She has to pee every 10 minutes, and when she leaves the other sales associate, Mary Jo, in charge of the store while she goes to the bathroom, something inevitably walks out of the store unpaid for. Mary Jo is 78 years old and myopic. Tabitha has to fire her, but she's worried about getting slapped with a lawsuit for being ageist. Megan will watch Ainsley. She is beholden to Tabitha because Tabitha is paying her through her maternity leave, despite the fact that she is a seasonal employee. But Megan won't want to do it. All Megan wants to do when she gets home is eat the low-sugar snacks she's allowed to consume and watch Ellen. On the one hand, Tabitha thinks it would be good for Megan to get some hands-on parenting experience, albeit at the other end of the spectrum. This is what your child will be like at 16 if you're very unlucky. On the other hand, Tabitha knows she should let Megan enjoy her last 2 or 3 weeks of caring for herself and enjoying quiet time with her husband, Jonathan. But if not Megan, then who? The next day finds Tabitha in a different waiting room, alternately paging through back issues of Town and Country and dozing with her head up against the concrete block wall. Eleanor is expected to be in surgery for a few hours, but Tabitha is afraid if she leaves the hospital, something awful will happen. If she stays here and suffers, Eleanor will be fine. At 12:30, Tabitha's phone rings. She checks the display. It's Ainsley. 12:30 means Ainsley is at lunch. No doubt she's wondering how much longer she's going to be left an orphan.
"Hi, sweetie," Tabitha says. "I'm trying to find someone to stay with you."
"I called Aunt Harper," Ainsley says. "She can be here tomorrow night and stay for as long as you need her to, but she wants to make sure you're okay with it."
"No," Tabitha says, "not Harper. Just let her come, Tabitha. Mama, I mean, sorry. Please, 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 please. That way you can take care of Grammy and not worry about me. Aunt Harper can stay as long as you need her to. She quit her job."
Quit her job? Tabitha thinks. More likely she got fired. Tabitha doesn't want Harper to be the one to fix things, because Harper never actually fixes things. She only makes things worse. Look at her life. Tabitha caught the doctor's wife's champagne in the face. And yet, having Harper come to watch Ainsley is an answer of sorts. It would allow Tabitha to go back to the townhouse on Pinckney Street once Eleanor is safely out of surgery to get some much-needed sleep. But then the memories assault Tabitha. Harper walking into the rental cottage on Prospect Street with a bouquet of wildflowers. Harper singing a song in Julian's tiny ear as she rocked him. The song was "If I Had $1 Million" by the Bare Naked Ladies. It calmed Julian immediately. It was the only thing that could. Harper making chopino with clams and mussels. The tomato-rich broth, the first real food Tabitha had eaten since Julian's birth. Harper braiding Tabitha's hair and ironing Tabitha's dress. A bottle of champagne with their bare feet dangling off the end of Old South Wharf. Dinner at 21 Federal, all eyes on the two of them. Dancing in the front row of the chicken box to a band that played old U2 songs. Harper's arm crooked around Tabitha's neck as they belted out the lyrics to "With or Without You." Tabitha can't think any further. It is simply too awful.
"No," Tabitha says to Ainsley now. "I'm sorry, but no. Not your Aunt Harper."
"But Mom,"
Ainsley says.
"No,"
Tabitha says, and she hangs up.